Create your podcast today using Anchor.
This is Stamsy Perspectives.
Hi everyone, welcome to the third episode of Stamsy Perspectives, a podcast by the Young Scientist Journal. I'm Max and I'll be one of your hosts for today's episodes. I'm interested in the fields of photochemistry and astrophysics.
And I'm Abby, and I'll be your second host for today. I'm interested in the fields of biochemistry and anything to do with viruses and bacteria. For today's episode, we'll be discussing the fields of biophysics and biochemistry and hearing from our guest, Dr. Christopher Barnes, a current postdoctoral fellow at the California Institute of Technology. He will also be joining Stanford University in fall 2021 as an assistant professor.
Dr. Barnes has been involved in a diverse range of research in structural biology. His research involves making use of cutting-edge techniques such as X-ray crystallography, electron microscopy, and NMR spectroscopy to resolve the structure of proteins and investigate cellular mechanisms.
His research has contributed to the fight against HIV, allowing scientists to design HIV-1 antibodies in order to eventually develop therapeutics. HIV-1 is the most common type of HIV infection. He has even co-authored papers which involved research aiming to eventually lead to the construction of an HIV vaccine, which is a particularly difficult task due to how easy it is for HIV to mutate to evade immune system-produced antibodies.
More recently, his work has involved investigating coronavirus. Using crystallography and different imaging techniques, he aims to understand the mechanism of immune response by understanding vital antigen interactions with host cells and antibody interactions with viral proteins.
He has also been involved in outreach, advocacy, and mentorship programs for K-12 students. And so let's turn to our guest, Dr. Christopher Barnes, to find out about his work on structural biology.
Hello, Dr. Barnes, and thank you very much for being here with us today. It's so great to have you on the podcast. I'm really excited for this episode. I'm Max, I'm one of the hosts, and then also we've got Abby as well.
I'm so excited to be interviewing you today. It's like I've just finished reading a book called The Coming Plague by Laurie Garrett, and it was written 20 years ago, and obviously it covers the HIV virus, so it's really interesting to be able to get like a 20 years later on view on it with your work that we'll be discussing later on.
No, yeah, this is all very exciting, and thank you, Max and Abby, for having me. I'm looking forward to the discussion we're going to have today.
Great, sounds amazing. So I guess the first thing to ask you is, could you tell us a little bit about your current work, what you're currently working on now in your position at Caltech?
Yeah, so basically to give a bird's eye view, I am a structural biologist. And what that means technically is that I look at how proteins and lipids and fats and carbohydrates, how they interact with one another, in order to understand the mechanism by which, biological processes occur. And so what I'm currently working on in Pamela Bortram's lab here at Caltech is to understand how viruses interact with our cells. And not only how do they gain entry into our cells by interacting with the proteins on the surface, but then also how does the immune system, right? How does it fight those viral infections? And so of course, when you're infected with a virus, your immune system will mount a response. And what we focus on in our lab and most of my work centers around the understanding of antibodies, right? These are the serum proteins that help combat pathogens. And it can be very specific to that said virus. And so I'm trying to understand exactly what makes these antibodies good at combating the virus and how can we then improve upon those characteristics by understanding how they fit together structurally. And so by doing that, we can help design new therapies. We can, of course, help design vaccines based off of protein-specific parts of the virus, that will be useful in a vaccine. So it's using a combination of structural biology along with immunology, we can really get a better understanding of what's going on.
Great. Sounds absolutely fascinating. It sounds like really important in this time at the moment to understand more about viruses and how they have an impact on our own immune systems and things like that. So yeah, great. Next question, Abby.
Yeah, so our second question is, how did you get started with your research and what initially pulled you towards the fields that you've decided to enter?
Yeah, the work I'm currently doing on SARS-CoV-2, that was kind of on a whim. We were sitting in a meeting back in January, and you know, SARS-CoV-2 became, started to come up on the radar. And it was like, oh, well, does someone want to work on this? I was like, sure, I'll work on it, not knowing that it was going to evolve into what it is today. So, science is like that. You sometimes just fall onto projects where, you might not think it'll go anywhere or might not be as important at the moment you agree to work on it. And then all of a sudden it becomes something that's, going to lead to a whole different career for me, a huge impact in the world. So, that kind of ties into how I started my career as a scientist as well. I started out thinking of going to medical school when I went to undergrad. And, I did some work in the lab, and that work in the lab was based off of, just like at UNC. So, yeah, space. And so, joining his lab introduced me to science, introduced me to, like I said, introduced me to biochemistry and to these techniques that I then use now today. And so that was kind of like an introduction where really I just fell into it. But I've always been interested in science and understanding how proteins work at the molecular level. And that, was really rooted in just, as a kid looking through the microscope and looking at, different things, how, little microbes would come and interact and eat cells and eat plants and stuff. So I've always been interested in how these things work. And so, so it's just really one of these situations where, you put yourself in a position and then that just kind of evolves into a path where you get to test many different things, know what you like, know what you don't like, and just continue along the path that you do like.
Amazing. So you said that you originally wanted to be a medical doctor, but decided against that and moved towards biophysics. I think we've got a lot of young listeners and young followers of the journal who have probably heard of biochemistry or of the kind of crossover between chemistry and physics, but biophysics is not one that people have probably heard of as much. So to kind of explain to the younger people in as few words as you can, but as simply as you can as well, what biophysics is, what is it the study of? What are you really doing on your everyday basis, or what are the biophysicists of the world up to at the moment?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, I had never heard of biophysics either until I went to graduate school and then joined the biophysics program. I actually hated physics as a student, as an undergraduate. That was like my least favorite subject. But biophysics is nothing more than the combination of trying to understand through physics, biology, right? And so I think, you always hear this pipeline, like if you want to understand biology, then you have to know chemistry. If you want to understand chemistry, you have to know physics. If you want to understand physics, you have to know math. Okay, so what biophysics is basically using physical terms and physical instrumentation, techniques to get at, understanding biological processes. And so really where this kind of implies is, we're using, spectroscopy techniques, right? They are really physics based to understand a biological process. So like in the case of my work, we're using X-ray crystallography. All right. So we're using, X-rays to, lead to diffraction of protein crystals. Right. And so this is all rooted in physics, right? Diffraction and wave properties of atoms and electrons. Right. So this is, how physics is involved. But that then allows us to understand the biological process behind these, different techniques. So at the end of the day, right, you're using something that's, like I said, based in physics to understand simple biological processes. And that is understanding how proteins are interacting with one another.
That's really, really interesting. I'd never really thought of it that way, I guess, because I mean, we learn about spectroscopy and stuff like that in chemistry. So I've always thought about it as chemistry based. But when you think about it, it's actually physics.
Right.
And it's really cool that you can link them and use, like, that's why I think, I don't know if you'd agree, but what's your view on the need for interdisciplinary scientists at a time like this?
No, I mean, I think you're totally hit the right points. Like, you don't think about how these things can mix together, but you know, that what you learn about physics in terms of chemistry, right, looking at how the atoms and the bonds are connected, you know, we do the same thing, you know, by understanding protein structures, right? And so this need for interdisciplinary research is really critical, especially at a time like this. And so, you know, in our own research here at Caltech, you know, we're, you know, biophysicists, structural biologists, and like, you know, for myself, like I had no experience in immunology or virology before coming to Caltech. And even though we're not, you know, technically a virology lab, you know, we collaborate with, you know, experts in the field. We collaborate with a guy, Michelle Nusenswag at Rockefeller University, who is doesn't understand anything about structures, but knows everything about B cell biology and virology, right? So we also, you know, work with Charlie Rice, you know, at Rockefeller, who just won the Nobel Prize for, you know, HCV, discovery of HCV. So if you look at the teams and the people that are leading these, you know, these huge endeavors and getting results, these are all interdisciplinary teams where we all have our own expertise, but by coming together to solve one problem, you know, that really helps you get there faster versus if you try to do it by yourself.
On that note, could you tell us a bit more about your work on HIV, and could you tell us, like, why is it important what you're doing and what sort of advancements will it bring?
So of course HIV is still a huge problem worldwide. You know, as of this summer, right, there's over 40 million known infected individuals worldwide with HIV, and we're still seeing close to a million new infections a year, and it still, you know, causes anywhere from 100 to 500,000 deaths a year. So it's still a huge problem, even though it's not talked about as much, especially in Western society, where we have very nice drugs and therapeutics to help, you know, prevent the spread of HIV, as well as to treat those who are currently HIV infected. So the work I'm doing currently in the HIV field relates to, it's very similar to what I'm doing in the SARS-CoV-2 field, which is understanding how the antibodies that are mounted by our own immune system help to neutralize or, you know, combat the virus. And so in the case of HIV, one thing that makes it different and very hard to actually make a vaccine for is because it has a high degree of mutation. It has a high mutation rate, basically, right? So, you know, if you look at the diversity of HIV virals, you know, at the sequence level within the individual, you know, you have, you know, tens of thousands of different strains at any point in one individual because of the different mutations that HIV can occur. So because of that, you have to, you know, this allows the virus to stay one step ahead of your immune system. And the antibodies that may be useful at finding, you know, a tenth of those strains won't be useful for the other 90%, or vice versa, right? And so if you have escape from antibody pressure, then, you know, the virus can continue to propagate and you will never be able to mount an effective immune response. So the work we do in HIV looks at, you know, certain individuals worldwide that have the ability to make antibodies that are really, really good. And so these antibodies, we call them broadly neutralizing antibodies. And what that means is that they can actually neutralize or combat, you know, anywhere from, you know, 70% to upwards of 95% of known HIV strains. And so this is really promising, right? Because if you have an antibody that has the ability to combat all these different the diversity of HIV strains, then that suggests that we can actually make these types of antibodies in a vaccine. So by understanding using structure, you know, that's what we do here, right? We take these proteins, these really good antibodies, and look at exactly where they bind on the virus and how they interact with the virus. And then we say, okay, well, how can we make something that will trigger or induce, right, these types of antibody responses? Okay, so this is called vaccine design. So we are using the structural information, our understanding of how these proteins interact with the virus in order to make vaccines that we hope will allow your own body to make them, right? So it's hard work, it's not easy. I mean, it sounds easy in principle, but in reality it's very difficult. And so understanding exactly the right strategy to induce these antibodies, requires a lot of information, both structurally as well as from animal studies. So we're getting there, we're progressing. Yeah, but it's the long road ahead still, I think, for HIV.
A question I have on that just is, I know that with some other viruses, if you in immunology, if you unleash the immune system, there is a small chance of stuff like cytokine storms happening. Is that something that you have to battle against with your research as well?
For HIV, not so much. I think for SARS-CoV-2, that was a huge concern. It was a rightful concern, because if you look at COVID-19, the disease is caused by SARS-CoV-2 viral infection. You see that this cytokine storm, this immune, overreaction of the immune system, is what's leading to these more severe COVID cases. This is also seen in other flaviviruses. Dengue is a prime example of this, where you have antibody, enhancement of disease. This is something that, as immunologists and virologists, people are in tune to. For HIV, you don't see this as much. And luckily for SARS-CoV-2, there is a type of immune, reaction, but that's different than some other severe ones, like in dengue, where antibodies actually help, lead to those more severe cases of dengue fever. To answer your question, we look at these things, but it's not something on our radar, in the sense that, for the most part, in the vaccine, especially for SARS-CoV-2, we don't expect the antibodies that are going to be raised from the vaccine to lead to a severe infection. We expect that these antibodies, along with the T cell help, will actually lead to protection against the virus.
Thanks for answering that. Max, to the next question.
Yeah. So you spoke about your work not being easy and being very difficult at times. Has this been made more difficult by the pandemic that's ongoing at the moment? I read that your lab was one of the only labs to be open for a certain period of time, or one of the labs among few to still be open. How has your work been impacted in the wake of the COVID-2 pandemic that's been ongoing?
Yeah, I mean, back in March and April, Pamela's group was one of the few labs that was open on the campus. And because of the uncertainty and just our lack of knowledge about the spread of the virus at the time and everything else, there was a lot of concern among safety individuals at Caltech when we were receiving samples from recovered patients to do our work. It definitely made it more difficult. Also having, only a handful of people allowed in our laboratory to work, that was probably the most difficult, because now, usually Pamela's lab, we have around 20 to 30 people in the lab at a time, and now we were down to four, myself and a couple other people. So that made the work a lot harder because we had to take on more responsibilities. And in the case, in this type of situation where, research is moving so fast, there's a need for speed and accuracy, right? And so, I think for our lab and for our collaborators, we realized that, but we didn't want our need for speed to make the science bad. And so that's something you have to really, guard against and when you're in a high pressure situation, when you're in a field where people want results quickly. Because if you looked in the media, right, everyone was jumping on any type of paper that was coming out even before it was reviewed, right? And so because of that type of pressure, that's an added pressure where you don't want to be wrong. And so we, made sure to take the time to ensure that our results would hold water and that we saw consensus. I mean, because I think at the time, a lot of people want to be first, but I'd rather be part of a consensus of scientists worldwide working on the same problem versus being first one to show this. So we were the first to do a couple of different things. But at the same time, as we published our papers, there were papers in the pipeline that we were privy to say, hey, yeah, they also see these same results. So that lets us know that what we're seeing, what others are seeing, and that helps build the consensus around these results, which is what you really want as a scientist, right? Your scrutiny in science is really important. And so you want to make sure that, you can stand up to the scrutiny with your results. So, I mean, I think that was the hardest issue is this, lack of people in working 12, 14-hour days, 7 days a week, and then trying to, do everything else that goes on top of, the research, including writing the papers, reading the literature. Staying on top of everything, has been made a lot harder when we were working with such a limited, group of individuals. But since summer, we've now expanded, we can have about 12 people in the lab at a time. And, that's allowed us to, do a little bit more work and not have to worry too much about everything else.
Great, so you're right on the way back to kind of getting to where you were, although what still working with a reduced size within your lab, it's still getting back to where it was. And I just wanted to pick up on, you said that you'd much rather be part of a consensus. So you're obviously a big believer in the whole kind of peer review process, not rushing to publish results and making sure that results that are published are, backed up by other sources, other studies that are going on, which I think is really important. So you obviously believe in that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to, especially in a case where there is so little information, about this virus. As much data as we have now, if you compare this to March, when COVID and SARS-CoV-2 was really rampant in the Western, society, we had very little understanding about what was going on. A lot of questions were still hanging out there. We didn't know what was happening. So when you see a result and you know these results are going to be published in Nature and Science and Cell, then you definitely want to make sure that you see it and it's not going to be wrong. Because just for instance, there was this mutation, right? This D614G mutation. When it was first published in a preprint, immediately it was picked up by New York Times, LA Times, here in the West, and it was spread like wildfire, saying, oh no, the virus is mutating, we're all in trouble. It's like, no, let's calm down. Like, the virus, yes, it has a mutation, makes it a little bit more transmissible, but that doesn't mean it has mutated away from antibody pressure or any type of vaccine that has been designed, right? So, I think this is the thing where, like, if you're gonna publish a result, then you wanna make sure to say, well, I see this, and it got picked up by me. Okay, well, this is really interesting. Is this good? Like, yes, this is good. And then now others see this. Now others are seeing this as well. So this lets you know that, this result is a good result and it's something that everyone is seeing. So therefore, we believe that this will be the end outcome for, whatever experiment we're working on at the time.
Create your podcast today using Anchor. If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's an easy way to record, edit, and produce a podcast. You can record using the app or your web browser. It has all the tools needed to produce your podcast, including transitions and sound effects. What's more is that you can also have group calls with up to 5 people recording simultaneously. When you set up your podcast, Anchor will automatically distribute your episodes to Spotify, Apple Music, and other major platforms. You can even activate sponsorships and earn money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. And the best thing is, it's all free of charge. Everything you need to make a podcast, all in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
So from what you're saying, it's better to be right than fast, which I think is something we can all relate to. Another question we have for you is, how have the fields of biophysics and biochemistry evolved throughout your scientific career? Have you seen a huge jump forward, or what has it been like being on the front lines of these fields?
Yeah, I think the technologies that have been developed to answer some of these biological questions is and the development of these technologies has been quite remarkable in the last, even 5 years. And so I can point to cryo-EM, right? So this is the major technique I use, which involves imaging single particles of proteins or viruses, using a microscope. And in the last 5 years, this technique has gone from, if you think about cryo-EM and the ability to and resolution of a hand, right? So if you if you are standing really, really far away from someone and you see them waving their hand, you might not be able to see exactly how many fingers they have up, right? But then the closer and closer you get to that hand, you can begin to resolve individual fingers and, you know, even, you know, start begin to see the lines on the palms of their hand, right? And so if you think about CryEM, you know, just 5 years ago, it was like, if I'm waving at you, I'm standing, you know, 1,000 feet away. And so I can see your arm up in the air. I can see your hand kind of going side to side, but I couldn't tell you if you had one finger up, if you had two fingers up, I couldn't tell you that, right? But now in the last 5 years, we've gotten to the point where I can see individual hairs on your hand. And I mean, that's quite remarkable if you think about, you know, that leap in technology, which now allows us to, again, understand even more precisely, you know, how these proteins are interacting with viruses, how they interact with, you know, sugars on the surface of cells. So that leap in technology has really aided our understanding and the development. And then you can look at, you know, the field of immunology and virology as well. The fact that we have a vaccine, you know, candidate vaccine, 9 months after getting the sequence for this virus that looks to be effective. I mean, that is a huge leap. You know, there's other things that go along with that, but just the technology itself, which has allowed us to basically plug in a sequence and come out on the other end with a vaccine that looks to be effective. I mean, that's really remarkable. So I mean, I think, you know, the investment that has been made in science and research development is going to be something I don't think is going to go away now as people, you know, understand and realize that we have a lot of problems that we need to address. And the more money we put into it, the faster we can address these problems.
So on top of that, would you then say that in the next, say, our generation, when we're older, this is when the almost the biggest push of new scientific discoveries will occur due to this technology boom?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as a structural biologist and as someone that's here, it's like, you know, right now we have all the low-hanging fruit has been picked. Right. We've made technologies, we've advanced things so that way we can answer some of the basic questions that have, you know, people have been addressing for many, many years. But now that you have technology, it allows you to begin to address these hard questions. Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be a huge push. And so one instance of this, right, we know so much more about the brain and neurology now than we did just 10 years ago, because we can map you know, brains of flies and other animals, and soon we'll be able to map all the networks in a human brain. So these are things that, you know, technology, as it advances, as we increase computational power, as we increase, just development, you know, working with people, working with engineers. You know, this goes back to our earlier question that you said, like this interdisciplinary, you know, sense. Like, I think it goes hand in hand with the fact, like, if you look at places like Stanford, UCSF, these places in the Bay Area here, who they partner with? They partner with Silicon Valley. They partner with, you know, NASA and JPL, like here at Caltech. We partner with these people because, you know, while they're working on things that go to the moon, well, their technology can actually be utilized in our experiments. And actually, you know, this is a true story. So the reason we can actually now look at, as I was talking about, me waving my hand from 1,000 feet versus, you know, really close up and seeing hairs. The advance in technology was due to the fact, you know, one thing you have to think about a readout of a camera is how to shield when you're bombarding it with electrons. Well, who needs shielding from electrons and radiation? NASA, right? And so actually that technology development from NASA that people were like, well, we can put this into our cameras to have that same shielding to help reduce the noise of these cameras. For imaging particles, right? So that's like one of these, you know, situations where, you know, interdisciplinary and taking ideas from other places allowed us to make a huge leap in our own science. So I think in your generation, you know, we have huge problems to tackle, and, you know, we're gonna need more development and technology to do that.
Wow, so there's obviously been a real big advancement in the last kind of 10, 20 years as this technology and sharing of technology across different kind of institutes and departments has really gone up as well. And hopefully that will continue in the future. And you've spoken a bit about where you think the future of biophysics, structural biology will go. But aside from the kind of future of this subject itself, what are your future career goals and how do you want to progress as a researcher?
Yeah, so I actually, my wife and I, we just accepted positions actually last month, or I guess in September, at Stanford. So we'll both be starting our labs at Stanford in the biology department. My lab will be working on, you know, viral host interactions, and her lab will be working on bacterial host interactions. And so, yes, I mean, I think, you know, as someone that never thought this would be my career path at the very beginning, at the onset of, again, like I said, when I started college, I thought I was going to be a medical doctor. But now I'm going to be leading the lab to help train the next generation of scientists in an environment where, you know, I'll be able to collaborate and to, you know, push forward the field of, you know, vaccine design, structural biology, and begin to address some of these hard questions. So I'm definitely looking forward to it. We'll start, you know, next summer in 2021. So it's going to be a fun time, I think. And yeah, I mean, it's a kind of a dream come true that I still can't believe it actually happened, but but I'm excited that it did.
Yeah, well, we wish you all the best for when you do start it, and I'm sure we'll be hearing about you in the future for lots of things that you're discovering and working on.
Yeah, thank you.
Just veering back to things and advice from you to our listeners. During your undergraduate, you were both a D1 athlete and pursuing a STEM major. So in graduate school, you were juggling parenting and your PhD program. How are you able to balance all of your responsibilities? And do you have any suggestions for an aspiring scientist who might be worried about the work-life balance in this field?
Yeah. You know, as an undergraduate, you know, I wouldn't say I balanced it technically. I got through it. It was definitely a lot harder than, you know, I took on too much, just put it that way. I mean, I, you know, was proud. It was like, oh, you know, I can do everything. I can, you know, be a double major. I can play, you know, football, and I can, you know, have a social life and sleep. It's like, no, you can't. You can't do all those. I just said I'm going to end up at Stanford, which is, you know, quite remarkable if you think about where I was as a college, you know, undergraduate. And I tell this to people all the time. I'm not ashamed of it. But, you know, I had I was a BC student in college. All right. So my GPA was 2.5 here, you know, on a 4.0 scale. I had 2.5 GPA. And, you know, by all means, that should eliminate me from being eligible for many graduate programs and from pursuing this career. And to think that I had a 2.5 GPA as an undergraduate, and now I'm about to be a professor at Stanford, you know, one of the best schools here in the United States, that just shows you that, you know, nothing is impossible. And, you know, what I think it takes related to, you know, going through my career, and what is the number one thing that is consistent, which is support and not being afraid to ask people for help. And I mean, I think that's really important. I mean, I think a lot of times we think we're alone in our struggles, we're alone in our own development, but you're not. You know, there are people there to help you. And, you know, so how did I get through that low GPA as an undergraduate? Well, I had a very good mentor who said, you know, I went to him saying, hey, I think, you know, I've enjoyed working in your lab. How can I make this possible? How can I make this into a career? All right. And so it would require him taking a chance and saying, okay, I believe in you. I believe that you can do the work. So let's get you to the point where others believe that you can do the work. So it took a longer route. So I had to do a master's and prove to people that, hey, I am a good scientist. I can write papers. I can do the work. Because that wasn't reflective of my undergraduate record. But again, that took going and asking for help, saying, this is my dream, this is what I want to do. I've messed up. How can I fix, you know, this bad GPA? Now in graduate school, you know, my wife and I had two kids as graduate students, and trying to do a PhD with two kids, I mean, that's not, you know, easy. And in this case too, our parents, we weren't close to our parents, right? So my parents were about 8-hour drive away. My wife's parents lived in Boston, so about 10 to 12-hour drive away. So we relied on that community around us, again, asking for help, you know, asking our PhD advisors, you know, hey, I can't be in that day, baby's out sick, or, you know, I have to leave lab early because we have a doctor's appointment. And having, you know, choosing the right mentors that are going to be supportive of those, you know, that life, right, that out of work life. And then asking, of course, you know, for support from the university. You know, having two kids in daycare with graduate salaries is not, you know, not doable for most people. But, you know, we went to people and said, hey, you know, we're graduate students. Like, we want to be in this daycare. You know, that would be the best thing for us. But, you know, how can we make this possible? And of course, people want to help. And I think that's the thing. Like, even in a divided world as we are, deep down, people want to help you. People want to help each other. And so, I mean, the best advice I give people is say, hey, don't be afraid to ask for help. Don't be afraid to reach out for support, because people are more than not willing to give that to you. And what's the worst thing they can say? No. That's it. They can say no, but for the most part, they're going to say yes, because they want to help you. So don't ever forget that. And I think that's the best advice I can give you. Just don't give up on your dreams just because you think it doesn't fit a mold that people, you know, say it should fit. You know, obviously 2.5 GPA doesn't fit the mold of a Stanford professor, but yet I'm a Stanford professor. And then I think it's funny too, on the flip side, my wife was a 4.0 student in college. And so it's like, you know, here's a 4.0 student, here's a 2.5 student. We're at the exact same place. We had the exact same career trajectory. So there's multiple ways to get to where you want to be.
I think that's great advice, that no matter what you've done in the past, you can really pick it up and step up a level and then really move forward productively and really get to a place that you wanted to be, even if you haven't had, you know, the first stages of the kind of classic stereotypical direction of travel towards that profession. So that's really great to hear that you've made it to where you wanted to go, but even in a field what you didn't even think you were going to go into. Another question, maybe slightly away from the topic of science, is what was your experience as a person of color in the field of biophysics, and did you ever feel mistreated by your peers or professors?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna sugarcoat it. You know, being a black scientist has been difficult. Especially growing up in the areas I grew up, right? So I grew up in North Carolina, in the South, where you already have these racial tensions and divisions. You know, I clearly remember being in the, you know, quote unquote nerd classes as a kid. You know, I would routinely be the only black person in my class. And this started, you know, from high school, right? So from, you know, 13 years old, you know, looking up and looking around and seeing that, hey, I'm the only black kid in these classrooms. Don't ever have a black teacher either, right, to interface with. You go to college and same thing, right? In most of the chemistry classes that I was taking, I was the only black kid in those classes. Again, not ever interacting with black professors. And so when events did occur, you know, who do you turn to? Do you turn to your classmates, who are your friends, but they don't have the same background or understanding of, you know, where you might be coming from, the same experience. What teacher do you turn to? You know, I had an advisor, but right, he's, you know, Gary was very sympathetic and empathetic to, you know, my needs and my struggles, but right, he couldn't fully relate to those either. So you know, then you carry this over into graduate school, where in the graduate program, I was the only black male scientist in that graduate program, and then it was another black female scientist. This is throughout the entire umbrella program that, you know, that was my graduate experience at Pitt. So again, you know, where do you turn to, you know, especially while being a graduate student, you know, some of the early, you know, the racial divisions in here really were expanded upon, and we had a lot of summers of you know, protests, right? And at the time, right, the world and here in the States, right, they view that very differently than they view the current protests of the day, right? So again, you end up feeling these feelings of isolation, which are real, and makes you think, you know, should I be here? Do I belong here? You know, obviously there's some microaggressions, people, you know, making comments, and and doing certain things that they feel they can do just because they're, you know, of the color of my skin. And so, yes, I mean, that was difficult. And I think a lot of people who experience this, you know, you have a choice. You can either allow those comments and that to dictate your life, or you can, you know, ignore it or deal with it in your own way, right? So, I mean, I think for everyone, you have to kind of figure out how to deal with these, you know, these issues because they're not going away soon. I mean, as much progress as we've made, there's still a ton of progress that needs to be made, especially so that way the next generation of scientists coming up after me don't feel that. And so, I mean, I think that's one of the main reasons I am looking forward to going to Stanford, not only for the science, but also for the impact I know I will have on that campus, being a scientist, a Black scientist. You know, that representation among those undergraduates, that representation among those graduate students who, you know, look around and don't see themselves in the professors that, you know, they are given the power to train them, right? So now they can see someone that looks like them in that position, you know, so that helps you help, you know, inspires them to be that. And same with my wife, you know, who's a Hispanic woman with, you know, heritages in from Ecuador, her dad's from Afghanistan, right? So having this mix, you know, to then go and be representative of, you know, certain individuals on that campus is going to, again, inspire people to, you know, go for their dreams. So it was tough. I got through it, still going through it, but it, you know, I go through it so that way I hope the next generation doesn't have to.
Yeah, and hopefully you'll be the kind of proof that people can make it to where you've got to, and really you can hopefully break the chain and really change how it feels for those undergraduates. That's really great to hear.
That's why initiatives such as like Black AF and STEM, which I don't know if you've looked at our Instagram, we did an interview with quite a few people involved in that initiative, I guess are really needed right now. So our last thing before we conclude is, what would be your advice to young scientists wanting to pursue research in these fields, and any like last remarks that you'd want our young listeners to hear from you?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you have a dream and you have aspiration, go for it. You know, there are always opportunities. And I think the hardest thing is to understand where those opportunities are and find those opportunities. And so, I mean, I think, you know, whether you're, you know, through your secondary school or in your college, begin to approach professors, begin to approach people. Again, like I said before, just ask people, you know, is there an opportunity to do research in your lab? Is there opportunity, you know, even as a high school student here, right? You know, I've trained a number of high school students, you know, through programs where it's just like, they want to have a lab experience. And so I'll take them on and say, yes, let's do this, both in throughout their academic calendar year, as well as in the summer. So just look for those opportunities to get involved in science research, in scientific research. They exist more often than not. And it doesn't have to be what you think you want to be either. All right. So, I mean, I never knew I wanted to be a biophysicist or a structural biologist. I just knew I wanted to do some work. I wanted to work in the lab. And so I wasn't picky, right? I just wanted to go in and get that experience. Because then once you begin to build that experience, you'll begin to understand how to read literature, how to understand papers. And then you can begin to think about, okay, well, this really looks cool. Like, I really want to now pursue, you know, instead of, you know, solving structures, I want to pursue engineering behind making these cameras better. Or I want to pursue this, you know, engineering to, you know, to make a microfluidic device for the delivery of a vaccine, right? So, I mean, so I think, you know, just going and finding those opportunities, you know, requires some work, especially, you know, if you're in a situation where your university or your school doesn't have, you know, these connections. But, you know, I think a lot of professors, a lot of people in the academic world are willing to help you reach those dreams. There's nothing more scientists like to see than, you know, young scientists that are really into, you know, their work. So definitely you know, pursue your dreams. For all those, you know, people of color, there are scientists, just know that you do belong. You know, you're going to be in environments where it might not seem like you belong here, and people might make comments, but just know you do belong, and continue to hold on to your dreams and really pursue them. And don't forget to ask for help. So, yeah.
Thank you very much. That's amazing advice for a lot of our young listeners and people looking to go into the STEM field. Can I just say it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast show and interviewing you. I've definitely learned a lot from someone who's more based in the physics and chemistry. It's been great to hear about what's happening in the larger structures and what you've been doing to kind of integrate biology with physics and how you're using physical processes to explain what you've been doing in your labs. So it's been amazing from my part to hear everything that you're getting up to. And on behalf of me and everyone else at the journal, we wish you all the best when you start your professorship in next year. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Max and Abby. It's been a pleasure. And yes, happy to do this, and I look forward to help spreading the word when the interview is available. So yeah.
Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of the STEMZ Perspectives podcast.
If you found anything particularly interesting, please leave us a voice message on podcast.ysjournal.com. We may even feature it in our next episode.
You can also shop for Young Scientist Journal official merchandise at shop.ysjournal.com.
We will also be introducing a donation option to help support our podcast soon on podcast.ysjournal.com.
You can find out more about the journal on our website and our social media handles, which will be linked in the description, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the podcast.